Hello and welcome to the first 10 pages. I am your host Keith and I am going to be reading one of the best scripts ever. That's right, we are talking A Christmas Story, one of the greatest movies of all time. Not just a great Christmas movie, just a great movie. So let's talk about A Christmas Story before we go into the script read. It was released in 1983. It was directed by a man named Bob Clark. Here's the thing about Bob Clark. He was most famous in the 80s, not for this movie, but for Porky's. If you don't know what Porky's is a teen comedy in the Animal House mold. After Animal House came out, for the next several years, for about a good decade, every studio was trying to recreate the success of Animal House. Porky's is one of the very few that probably surpassed it. And it is very naughty. I have no idea if it stands the test of time. What I do know is that now it seems that what Bob Clark has become a little more famous for is an otherwise little seen horror film, a slasher that is in the mold of Halloween, but was made before Halloween. Yes, before John Carpenter's Halloween was Black Christmas. Black Christmas really exploits the whole idea of the boogeyman, which is exactly the thing that John Carpenter was trying to do with Halloween. I say trying to do, but he did very successfully. However, when you compare it to what Bob Clark, who wrote and directed Black Christmas, did in that movie, I feel like in terms of the unknown boogeyman, Black Christmas is more successful on that aspect. Halloween is more successful at being a suspenseful, fear-inducing horror film. I would recommend taking a look at Black Christmas, especially if you're a lover of A Christmas Story and a lover of the Halloween movies. That said, let's move back to A Christmas Story. Let's get back on track here. The screenplay was by Gene Shepard, Lee Brown, and Bob Clark. It was based on two books from Bob Clark. 1966's In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, and his 1971 book, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. Okay, now let's take a minute and discuss Lee Brown, the other credited writer on the film, who's not often discussed in conversations for some reason. Like, she just seems to be barely mentioned in anything that I've looked up. She doesn't even have a link on Wikipedia. Wikipedia, stop asking me for money if you're not going to link Lee Brown's bio. What are you even doing here? Okay, who was Lee Brown? She was the wife of Gene Shepard. According to the Flick Lives fan website, she was his companion and radio show producer since the mid-70s, and the two were together until her death in 1998. Shepard died just over a year later. She had also published a book, and if you want to find that book, it was called... It was called The Show Gypsies, and it centered on horse shows. It was published in 1975. She clearly had a love for animals. When Shepard passed away, he asked for a fund set up, I think it was at the University of Pennsylvania, but I could be mistaken, for veterinary care. So that was in her honor. She's also in A Christmas Story. She has an uncredited appearance. She's the woman in line for Santa Claus who's got curly hair and wearing a red hat. So keep an eye out for her. The cast includes... of course, Peter Billingsley as Ralphie Parker. Gene Shepard doing the narrator voice, which is adult Ralphie. Ian Petrella as Randy. Melinda Dillon as Mom. Darren McGavin as the old man. Scott Schwartz as Flick. R.D. Robb as Schwartz. Zach Ward as Scott Farkas, which for years I always thought was Scott Farkas, but is Scott Farkas. I noticed that, I don't know, like 10 years ago? But for the many years prior to that, I thought it was Scott. And a bunch of other people. Yeah, you get the idea, right? It has a cast in it. People star in it. The movie was released November 16, 1983. Your host saw it sometime within the first 2 weeks of that date. I don't know exactly when. So with my big sister. She was unimpressed. I thought it was genius. The budget for the movie was $3.3 million. While it made money at the box office, it was a modest success at best at $19.2 million. further, and this is according to Wikipedia, and yes, Wikipedia, I donate it. I donate every year. Can you get rid of the big yellow box, okay? And also, do better at begging for money. You're really annoying about this. And I don't donate because you're annoying. I donate because I use Wikipedia a lot, and you just need to take it down a notch, guys, okay? Anyway, where was I? According to Wikipedia, Bob Clark gained interest in making this film and in Gene Shepard's stories upon hearing the story Flick's Tongue, which was unpublished, but Shepard had read on his WOR radio talk show, WOR being a station in the New York, New Jersey area. And according to this, Shepard and Clark, who you'd think would have gotten along famously because they made this incredible film, did not get along. According to this information, which cites how Christmas Story went from low-budget fluke to an American tradition in Vanity Fair from November 2016, Shepard envisioned his stories as Dickens's Christmas Carol as retold by Scrooge. I guess the idea is supposed to be that Ralphie, as an adult, is not a big fan of Christmas any longer, which is fascinating. Or at least was not a big fan of Christmas during that period. Scrooge does have an arc where he starts to appreciate Christmas and the people around him and all of those things, right? So does he mean Scrooge before the three ghosts or Scrooge after the three ghosts? I don't know. At any rate, they didn't get along. And apparently, Clark had a banned Shepard from the set. That's what it says here. That's what it said in the Vanity Fair article, because Clark softened the approach for the film. In the script read, you will see that there is a lot of unnecessary descriptives of location. There's also real big focus on making sure that the images that we see are of their time, which today, if you were to write a script or adapt stories to a screenplay, there would be, to some degree, an assumption that your director and set designers and scenery dressers, that they would understand these things, and you would put in maybe a couple of reference points just to make it clear. This script goes into a great amount of detail, some of which we'll discuss. So, again, just to be clear, here's what we do on the first 10 pages. We read the first 10 pages of the script, and we talk about how that compares to the first 10 minutes of the film, the actual film, because 1 minute of script essentially equals 1 minute of film. Then we will discuss what works and how those first 10 pages really set up every single thing you need to know about this movie, which, if you're a writer, is something you should consider. It's, yes, your first act sets up all your storylines, but your first 10 minutes sets your tone, your setting, who your main character is or will be. And that doesn't mean you can't break these rules. Of course, you can break the rules, but you got to know them first, and you got to get them right, and you got to see how others do it in order to do that. And that's why we are here. Boom. Okay, so let's do the script read. If you want to skip the script read, which you shouldn't, because it's fun. It might be the best part, because I'm boring, but the scripts are good. Go to
23 minutes.
A Christmas Story, a film based on original material by Gene Shepard. Screenplay by Gene Shepard, Bob Clark, Lee Brown. Shooting script, December 7, 1982. Exterior, the still mills loom. Long shot, dusk. Graphic says Northern Indiana, sometime in the 1940s. Fade up to find Homan, a steel town squatting beside Lake Michigan. Camera pans the city, then begins a series of cuts to show even more microcosmic views of Homan. The narrator's voice, Gene Shepard, fades up. We hear a medley of classic Christmas carols which form a striking contrast to the images. Ralphie, Flick, and Schwartz run across a slag heap in foreground. Randy trails behind. Narrator, VO. Homan, Indiana. It clings precariously to the underbody of Chicago like a barnacle clings to the rotting hulk of a tramp steamer. On the far horizon beyond the railroad yards and the great refinery tanks lay our own mysterious private mountain range. Dark and mysterious, cold and uninhabited, the steel mills attacked like malignant dominoes against the steel-gray skies. Exterior junkyard dusk. Kids run past dilapidated fence. Narrator. early December had seen the first of the great blizzards of that year. The wind howling down out of the Canadian wilds a few hundred miles to the north screamed over frozen Lake Michigan. Exterior, Pulaski's candy store, dusk, kids race by, Randy trails, and hit Homan, laying on the town, great drifts of snow and long story-high icicles and sub-zero temperatures where the air cracked and sang, streetcar wires creaked under caked ice, and kids plodded to school through 45 miles an hour gales, tilting forward like tiny furred radiator ornaments. Exterior, downtown Homan, night, filled with cars and shoppers, but over it all, like a faint, thin offstage chorus, was the building excitement. Christmas was on its way. Each day was more exciting than the last, because Christmas was one day closer. Exterior, downtown Homan, tracking shot, kids weaving amongst shoppers, night. Lovely, beautiful, glorious Christmas, around which the entire kid year revolved. Downtown Homan was prepared for its yearly bacchanalia of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Exterior, Higbee's department store, extras, night. Camera cuts to a wide shot of Higbee's department store window. Citizens stand, oohing and eyeing, in front of the Yule splendor. Camera moves in toward the window. Higbee's department store's corner window was traditionally a major high watermark of the pre-Christmas season. It set the tone, the motif of their giant Yuletide jubilee. Kids were brought in from miles around just to see the window. Old codgers would recall vintage years when the window had flowered more fulsomely than in ordinary times. This was one of those years. The magnificent display had been officially unveiled on a crowded Saturday night. It was an instant smash hit. Camera pans, the rapt faces peering in. One little boy, Ralphie, comes bobbing up between the legs of a startled grown-up. We see Flick, Schwartz, and Randy also. First night's packed earmuff to earmuff. Okay, that's a typo, because in the movie he says something else, so I'm going to reread that with the correct word, nighters, not nights. First nighters, packed earmuff to earmuff, their steamy breath clouding up the sparkling plate glass, jostled in rapt admiration before a golden tinkling panoply of golden tinkling panoply of mechanized electronic joy. Yeah. Camera pans the window. Over this shot, we see the opening titles. This is the heyday of the Seven Dwarfs, and this is a really long paragraph in the script. This would never, ever be written today, but here we go. This is the heyday of the Seven Dwarfs and their virginal den mother Snow White. Walt Disney's seven cutie pies hammer and chisel and paint while Santa, bouncing Snow White on his mechanical knee, ho-ho-hos through eight strategically placed loudspeakers, interspersed by choruses of hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go. Grumpy sits at the controls of a miniature eight-wheel Rock Island Road steam engine, and Sleepy plays a marimba, while in the background, inexplicably, Mrs. Claus ceaselessly irons a red shirt. So, in case you haven't caught up, this is the description of the window we were supposed to see in Higbee's. It obviously is not exactly what we saw. There's many, many differences, including the fact that Snow White is just a cardboard cutout in the movie. Anyway, I'm going to continue. This paragraph is not yet done. Sparkling artificial snow drifts down on Shirley Temple dolls. Flexible flyers and Tinker Toy sets glowing in the golden spotlight. In the foreground, a frontier stockade built of Lincoln logs is manned by a company of kilted lead Highlanders who are doughtily fending off an attack by six U.S. Army medium tanks. In parentheses, history has always been vague in Indiana, okay? A few feet away stands an Arthurian cardboard castle with Raggedy Andy sitting on the drawbridge, his feet in the moat through which a Lionel freight train burping real smoke goes round and round. Dopey sits in Amos and Andy's pedal-operated fresh air taxicab beside a stuffed panda holding a lollipop in his paw, bearing the heart-tugging legend, Hug Me. From fluffy cotton clouds above, Dion quintuplet dolls wearing plaid golf knickers hang from billowing parachutes, having just bailed out of a high-flying balsa wood Fokker triplane. All in all, Santa's Workshop makes Salvador Dali look like Norman Rockwell. Okay. Narrator. It was a good year. Maybe even a great one. Like a swelling Christmas balloon, the excitement mounted until the whole town tossed relentlessly in bed and made plans for the big day. Already my own scheme was well underway, a scheme whose Machiavellian brilliance and Olympian perseverance made that Christmas stand out among Christmases past. Camera pans from Ralphie's rapt face to the beaming face of Red Rider, who is hustling the Daisy BB rifle to aching kids everywhere. We dissolve to the entranced face of Ralphie. Interior, Ralph Parker's house. Day. Camera pulls back to reveal that Ralphie is reading Boy's Life. Downstairs, we hear the hectic routine of a school morning. The omnipresent radio cackles in the background. Ralphie's father, hereafter known as the Old Man, roars dimly in the distance as he fights the good fight against the indefatigable Indiana winter. Ralphie's mother calls intermittently the waning minutes before school deadline. I remember clearly, itchingly, nervously, maddeningly, the first time I laid eyes on it. Pictured in a three-color smeared illustration in a full-page back-cover ad in Boy's Life. Camera cuts to Ralphie's point of view and starts a slow zoom into the smiling face of Red Rider. We see the following copy on the page. Boys, at last you can own an official Red Rider Carbine Action 200-shot range model air rifle. Red Rider, his jaw squared, staring out at me manfully and speaking directly to me, eye to eye. In his hand was the knurled stock of as beautiful as coolly deadly looking a piece of weaponry as I'd ever laid eyes on. Camera pans over its page, seeing the following copy as we hear Ralphie begin reading it out loud to himself. Ralphie.
Yes, fellows, this 200-shot carbine action air rifle, just like the one I used in all my range was chasing them rustlers and bad guys, can be your very own. It has a special built-in secret compass in the stock for telling the direction if you are lost on the trail, and also an official Red Rider sundial for telling time out in the wilds. You just lay your cheek against this stock, sight over my own special design cloverleaf sight, and you just can't miss. Tell Dad it's great for target shooting and varmints, and it will make a swell Christmas gift.
Yes, that's right. In my version of this, Ralphie is played by Buddy Hackett. So, roll with it. The sound of Ralph's voice reverberates and echoes.
Make a swell Christmas gift. Makes a swell Christmas gift. Makes a swell Christmas gift.
Camera cuts to Ralphie and begins a slow zoom into his eyes. Narrator. A swell Christmas gift. Here was Red Rider himself, nailing me, his pal Ralphie, with his calculatingly demonic underplay, knowing full well that it was not merely a swell Christmas gift, but the Christmas gift, the quintessential Christmas gift, the holy grail of Christmas gifts. For the first time in my life, the initial symptoms of genuine lunacy, of mania, set in. Camera has arrived in an extremely close shot of Ralphie's eye. We dissolve to the following, which is Ralphie's daydream fantasy. Dissolve to interior, Ralph's kitchen. Extreme close-up, Ralphie's eye, day. Camera pulls back to see Ralphie on one knee, his trusty Red Rider air rifle at the ready. As camera continues to pull back, we see Ralphie's father huddle in the corner, his arms about Ralphie's mother, whose eyes roll with cosmic fear. Goodness gracious, we're poetic. At her feet, Randy, Ralphie's brother, is clasped in his mother's desperate arms, his fingernails poised before his chattering teeth. His eyes stare as if they beheld the coming of the millennium. This is all in the action, by the way. This is not narrator. This is just the action description. Ralphie's father speaks.
Save us, Ralphie, for your mother's sake.
Close up, Ralphie.
With Herculean calm, Ralphie turns to them.
Don't worry, Dad, as long as I got old Blue.
He holds up his BB air rifle. Then, camera cuts behind. What is obviously the kitchen sink of Ralphie's house. Slowly, Ralphie's face appears over the edge. The steely eyes survey the scene before him. Exterior backyard, Ralphie's point of view. Day. Looking past the kitchen faucet and out the kitchen window, we see what Ralphie sees.
At various points across the backyard, desperate men are creeping on their bellies across the snow toward the house. There are about 8 of them, and each wears a thin bandit burglar-type black mask. A.K.A. a domino mask, but doesn't say that. The kind that looks like goggles. It's a domino mask, dude. They all wear striped shirts and carry blackjacks. One nears the house. 2 are slinking over the fence. 1 crawls through the garage door. Medium shot, Ralphie. He surveys the situation coolly. Then fast as a whipsnake, he leaps up and snaps off 3 shots. I like that. Long shot, the yard. 3 bad guys leap acrobatically into the air, mortally wounded. The others stand up, stricken into dumbness by the sting of Old Blue. They race unceremoniously and plunge headlong over the fence and disappear down the alley. We cut back to the family. They cheer wildly, embracing Ralphie. Ralphie stands tolerating this, stoically but kindly. Family. I guess everyone in unison is supposed to be saying this. You saved us, Ralphie. You saved us. We were all goners, Ralphie, and you saved us.
Me and Old Blue. Of course, there was some that didn't want me to have Old Blue.
Close up the family. Narrator. They look down in abject humiliation under my stern but kindly reprimand. The truth had smote them. Close up, Ralphie. I turned away after a moment, staring into the danger zone bravely, heroically, with just a trace showing in my eyes of that distant hurt that was afflicted upon me by my now contrite family. Suddenly, Ralphie is startled, and we hear a voice. Back to reality.
Ralphie? Randy? Downstairs in 2 minutes.
Interior bedroom, Ralphie Day. We realize Ralphie has been jarred out of his fantasy by his mother's voice. He leaps up and scurries to get ready. Randy plunges into the drawer and starts to do his little brother thing. 2 minutes means 2 minutes. Mother knows nothing about creeping marauders burrowing through the snow toward the kitchen, where only you and you alone stand between your tiny, huddled family and insensate evil. There was no question about it. Not only should I have such a gun, it was an absolute necessity. Racing memories of kid plots through the ages began to surge through my cortex into conscious strategy. Interior parents' bedroom, Ralphie Day. Camera follows Ralphie into his parents' room, where we see him pick up a copy of Screen Romance and slip Boy's Life between the covers. My mother, grabbing for her copy of Screen Romances, would find herself cleverly euchred into reading a Red Rider sales pitch.
Ralphie! Randy!
Medium shot the hallway. Camera follows Randy and Ralphie down the hallway, losing Randy and following Ralphie to the bedroom, to the bathroom door. He barges in and we find the old man in the final strokes of shaving. He looks down at Ralphie. Ralphie cleverly puts the Boy's Life behind his back.
What you got there?
Nothing.
I'd say that's the end.
Okay, well, that was the script. Boy, what a ride. All right. Let's talk about some of the references in the description of that store window. Higbee's? Yes. Now, some of these are self-explanatory. Everybody knows who Walt Disney is and the 7 dwarfs are in Snow White, so we don't have to cover that. So let's talk about some of the other things in the window, just so we can understand how Gene Shepard felt it was necessary to really set up his point of view of what a toy window was in the 1940s. Yes, it's a tangent from what we're here for, but I think it's kind of fascinating. If this was a short story of his and I saw this description, because this is a prose description for a short story, that long paragraph that I referenced during the script read, I would have broken this down into a couple of quick bullets of, we see this, 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 and other things of the time, you know. But what's interesting is he didn't just hit on very popular things that still are referenced today. Yes, he mentions Raggedy Andy, which is in the window. He mentions Snow White, who is in the window, although not to the degree that he's talking about here. Some of these other things he mentions are indeed in the window, but we don't see them all. We don't see them the way he describes them. Some of the less obvious things, oh, Shirley Temple dolls. I don't recall seeing a Shirley Temple doll, but it just goes to point out how sort of big of a deal Shirley Temple was, and flexible flyers are, and Lincoln Logs. There's a mention of kilted lead Highlanders. Those are the little metal, they look like British soldiers. Some of the long-forgotten toys that are mentioned along with those include Dion Quintuplets. Looking at Wikipedia again, and for God's sake, yes, please,
please donate to them so they leave us alone. Just do it. Just give them their $2.
$2.
Give them their $2. So the Dion quintuplets are the first quintuplets known to have survived their infancy. The identical girls were born just outside Callander, Ontario, near the village of Corbel. According to this, it looks like that one of the earliest mentions of them in pop culture was a painting by Andrew Loomis called School Days. Raymond Chandler mentioned them in a novel in 1939. In the Marx Brothers movie A Night at the Opera, Chico makes an oblique reference to the quintuplets when he says that duplicates are those five kids in Canada. Oh yeah, I remember that line. In My Man Godfrey, also a very big movie like Night at the Opera, it references the Dion quintuplets with the line, "If a woman in Canada can have five children, why can't Godfrey?" They were being mentioned all over the place, apparently, for many years, according to this long list of references. When I looked it up, there were paper dolls and actual dolls and all kinds of little things that were made at the time. So yeah, they would have been in the window. A Rock Island Road steam engine. These were apparently commuter trains in Chicago, based on what I can find via Google, so take it with a grain of salt, but this seems to be correct. The Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad lines were a Class 1 railroad operated across 14 states in the American Midwest. That fits. So what we saw in the window was toy train versions of that. At least what is described in the script. In the script is supposed to be toy train versions of that, along with a Lionel train set. Lionel being probably the most famous toy manufacturer of toy train sets. Go buy one. They're fun. A flexible flyer is, of course,
Rosebud.
A sled. Tinker Toys, for those who don't know because you're not 80 years old or over, were, I think, originally just wooden toys, dowels and circles and things that you'd fit together. You'd tinker with them to make little, I don't know, toys of some kind. They're for little inventors, I think, is how they promoted it. You know, you can make something that kind of looks like a train and something that kind of looks like a car and something that sort of looks like a house. You know, kind of like Lego. It's pre-Lego. And finally, there's a mention of Amos and Andy and their Fresh Air taxi cab. Amos and Andy are hard to explain. I'm not going to. No. Not gonna do it. Look it up. It ain't good, guys. Just, it ain't good. But, yeah, they were very, very, very popular. And sure, a toy based on something from their show would definitely be in that window. I don't think it made it into the movie. But yeah, man, it's not good. It's not. Let's talk the many differences between the script and what's on screen. The first big difference,
obviously,
is all of the beautiful Gene Shepherd text that sets up the town and the, you know, the smokestacks and what this place is outside of it being anywhere was fully removed. And honestly, for good reason. Although, it seems like it may have been removed in post because there is a remnant of it. A mention of the town, Homan, which I'd never clocked before, comes in at about 1 minute 30 seconds. So it's interesting that remained. That says to me that they were cutting around all these things were recorded and they cut around them. There's things later on in the script that I read that were switched around in what was on screen, and I think that works better too. The state, the town, and its name never seemed important to me. They still don't. The idea that this is anywhere USA, although clearly a suburb of some big city, in the early 40s always made more sense than having it be very specifically about Gene Shepherd's world and what he experienced, because the way it's portrayed in the film that we got, it's more universal. In the script, when Ralphie fantasizes about saving his family, it's his dad who shouts,
"Save us, Ralphie!"
But in the film, it's his mom. And here's an interesting thing. Ralphie, who's seen in the foreground at a completely different spot than in the reverse shot, responds by saying in that reverse shot, "Don't worry, Dad. As long as I've got old Blue, I've got this." This means one of two things. Multiple takes or a reshoot. Considering their low budget, I have to assume the former of the two. In the movie, they use the fantasy as a means for us to get to know not just Ralphie and how his mind works, but to tell us more about the BB gun to ensure we the audience, you know, get it? So the first 10 pages of the script, set up the town, the tone of the 40s, but not necessarily the tone of the movie as a whole, and set up Ralphie and his adult self as a dreamer and as a boy, someone with a wry sense of humor, but a point of view that's very myopic. That is, it's very much the point of view of a child who believed that his world is the whole world. That's in the script. The movie does that as well, but does it with a little more gravitas, something that feels more movie-like. Jumping into the family and the Christmas feeling a little faster, it better sets the tone, giving us a clear understanding that this is a Christmas movie, not a movie about a family in an industrial town that happens to be taking place at Christmas time. It's more of a, like I said, an Anytown USA vibe, and less of a feeling of, hey, this is just my story and I want you to hear it. Which, to be fair to Shepard, was something he did successfully on the radio for many years. So there's no reason for him to have not assumed that that's how the movie was going to portray it and how Bob Clark was going to want to portray it. By the way, if you've never heard or seen Shepard read his stories, you could go to the Flick Lives website. They have a huge archive of them. I haven't clicked them, so I hope that they're still live and that they still work. I think they do. I only went to the site very briefly to learn about Gene Shepard's wife, Lee. And the other place you can go to is YouTube. Gene Shepard was on Letterman's show a bunch of times, and he would read his stories while on David Letterman's late night NBC program from the 80s. So go look for that. It's good stuff.
Now, where was I? I don't know. I have notes, and I kind of, sort of follow them, sort of, kind of, in a way, a little bit.
Okay. The other thing that the movie does is it sets up the parents a little more strongly in those first 10 minutes. Again, obviously, if you're a screenwriter, you get all of Act 1 to set up your story, your main characters, the general tone and feeling of what's going on and where we're going and how we're going to treat this world. Yes, but in a studio, they want to be pulled in within your first 10 pages. And as such, movies tend to give us all the most important bits in the first 10 minutes, because again, page of script is a minute of screen time, generally speaking. So we get to meet Mom. We learn that she's sort of the doting but smartly aware mom who seems to be just going about her motherly business, but more or less knows everything that's going on around her family. I mean, you know, save for the fact that the old man buys the kid an official Red Ryder Carbine Action 200-shot range model air rifle, and also doesn't seem to know where Ralphie heard that word, you know, the one later on.
Fudge.
It also gives us a better understanding of the old man and the family dynamics in those first 10 minutes. Because we see how he interacts with his wife. They seem to have a nice relationship. He tells her about baseball. She goes, that's nice. He asks her a question about something that no one on earth would know. She knows it like that. And he goes, how do you know that? Everybody knows that. So they have a nice relationship. There's a nice balance there. They also lay pipe for the contest, which later brings us to the famous leg lamp and puzzles. He's interested in puzzles,
something we see Ralphie is into later on with his little orphan Annie and Ovaltine decoder ring.
So I don't know if that was a purposeful connection. It looks like that it might be a little bit of Ralphie trying to emulate the old man, much like him saying words that the old man uses. The other thing we learn about the old man is that he's a most feared furnace fighter, which gives us a lot of stuff later on in his ability or inability as a do-it-yourselfer. The script itself gets to that stuff, but a little bit later. The movie changes something else that's very minor, which is the magazines mentioned in the script. That's likely due to rights clearances and such. Although, squeaky clean, super careful, and litigious Disney was okay with their IP being used, so you'd think that whoever owned Boy's Life would be okay with that. I don't think we ever get to see the title Boy's Life on that magazine. But who knows what happened? Could have been any number of things. The runny gag of Ralphie's little brother lagging behind is set up in the script, but we don't get in the movie until a little bit later, after 10 minutes. It's not something we see until Ralphie's off to school, which happens a few minutes after the kitchen scene.
Okay, so let's sum it all up, right?
Yeah.
All in all, it looks like we've another example of an excellent script that was improved in the editing suite by the director, who decided to
keep better focus on what's really needed for the A story and on character development. I think these are lessons we writers can learn. If you look at my Jaws episode and how Spielberg handled that script differently from what was submitted, and even at the Pulp Fiction script and the way Tarantino wrote and focused on all the things he really wanted to do in that movie in those first 10 minutes, or on the Get Out episode and how Jordan Peele took what was going to be, it seems, a much lighter story that was maybe sort of a light thriller or maybe a comedy thriller even, and really focused it, really honed it into something that was just terrifying and sets up that terror early on perfectly. This movie kind of does the same thing by cutting out all the additional information about the town and panning across the sky and all that stuff. We get right into who we are focusing on, why we're focusing on them, what time of year, what time of time period, all that stuff so much faster in a much smarter way. Not to undermine Gene Shepard's brilliance. Let's keep that in mind. This movie wouldn't exist without him. And it is still very much Gene Shepard's work. Let's also acknowledge that. I think I've covered everything about A Christmas Story. So with that, that's all for me and the first 10 pages. Before we go, a quick shout out to people in France who apparently laughed enough at my attempts at speaking their language on my Get Out episode that they catapulted me to number 107 on the list of top entertainment and film podcasts on Apple. I mean, the fact that enough people listened to mine to put me in number 107, that's pretty cool. You know, there's got to be at least 108 of them, right? That anyone's listening to mine is awesome. So thank you. I mean, merci beaucoup. Anyway, next month, I'll be back with more of the holiday spirit. I'm not sure yet which script and which movie I'll be looking at, but I'm figuring it out. Thank you all so much. Au revoir. Merci beaucoup. Pour les rôtis. Yes, I'm well aware what that means. See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read. The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2025.